Hello everyone and welcome to a special edition of The History of England.
Before I start, let me just warn you to go right to the end of the episode when you're all done to listen to hear about a poll and prize draw that we're all going to be having next week on the good old cause, the English Revolution, the Wars of Three Kingdoms, whatever you want to call it. Now,
you all know that I'm a big fan of the Ladybird children's history books. First of all, I am a child of Loughborough, where the brand was invented, so you know, my tribe and all that. But more importantly, they inspired me as a kid to just love history. Nowadays, we use them as a bit of a source of historiography at various points, as you know, because of course, they offer a view of history from a particular time and period in time, so it's fun to go back and see how the history world was seen then. So, we are going to talk about Laurence Dugard Peach today, and I am lucky enough to have an expert along with me today, David Perkins. Hello, David, and introduce yourself.
Hi, David. Yes, I'm Dr. David Perkins. I'm a former head of history, now head of arts and humanities at the King's School, Canterbury. King's is commonly regarded as Britain's oldest school. There's been no interruption since in education since 597 AD. Unless you don't count the Reformation, but it was always the same people anyway, so it's just a bit of a rebrand. So we've been engaging in teaching and learning for more than 1,400 years, and the school is located in the precincts of Canterbury Cathedral. But I kind of grew up with Lady Bird books, and a chance discovery and holiday in Derbyshire a few years ago led to a rekindling of interest in the legendary Adventures from History series, as well as their multi-talented author, Laurence Dugard Peach.
So the author. Now, before we go into that, I suppose there are four participants in the story. There's the publisher, the imprint and the format, the illustrators, and then the readers. But central to the story is the author, the person responsible for presenting to young people what was very often an early view for them of history. His name, as you say, was Laurence Dugard Peach, and we're going to talk about him and his background and his wider work, which was extensive and varied. So tell me a little about Peach then, David. Where was he born? When was he born? And so on.
Laurence Dugard Peach was born in Sheffield. He was, as you know, he was the author of most of the titles in the Adventures from History series. That, for him, was something of a retirement project. It's just one facet of his creative output. I think it's important to kind of give a flavour of Peach's life and career, because some people today have a feeling that maybe from his name that he was a posh establishment type figure who ended up writing posh establishment type history in the Lady Bird Adventures from History series.
Yeah, so there's something about his name, isn't there?
Yeah, it continues to attract attention as if it has a kind of special quality. And even back in the 1930s and 1940s, when Dugard Peach was a household name, children, adults even, would sometimes say Eldegard as if it was one long name. He was actually just plain Laurence Peach. Dugard was his middle name, but he wrote under the name Eldegard Peach, and he was known to his friends as Laurie.
So tell me about his background.
He was the son of a Unitarian minister. He won a scholarship to Manchester Grammar School and then to Manchester University, where he gained a BA in English in 1912, a third-class degree, which in those days equipped you to go and do a master's degree and a PhD. You have to try quite hard these days to get a third, or you would have done in the 1990s, or maybe you'd not try. I think it's worth mentioning that the family had quite a social commitment. His father, Charles Peach, had a charity, Send a Child to Great Hucklow. The idea was to get kids from the slums of Manchester and Sheffield and get them a week in the fresh air. He set it up with the Reverend Lawrence Scott, who was the brother of the famous Guardian editor C.P. Scott. And that charity still exists today. So I think it's fair to say that Peach, despite his reputation as being a bit posh, knew quite a lot about how the other half lived. He's not really a classic establishment figure. He's a kind of scholarship boy. But back to his background, in 1912, he went to study in Germany at Göttingen, and he had quite a close shave in 1914. He got out of Germany with hours to spare before the declaration of the First World War.
Oh, closer on thing.
Yeah, definitely. But his overall experience of the First World War was that he was shot at, blown up, nearly died, lost quite a few of his friends, but still managed to have a great time. And I think he kind of came...
A bit like teaching history then.
Well, kind of. But I think he came back with a determination to live life to the full, to take every opportunity, and basically to have fun, live life on his own terms.
Okay, so what did you do next?
Well, he took a PhD in the comparative history of drama at Sheffield University in 1921, and then became, after a period school teaching, he became a university lecturer. And in the end, he dropped out of the academic rat race in 1926 to set himself up as an independent author. His father kind of advised him against it, saying it was a risky business.
So listen to this, kids. Always do what your dad tells you. They've got a lot of sense.
Yeah, so he went to live in a cottage in the High Peak of Derbyshire and lived there for the rest of his life and was able to make a good living. It's perhaps worth noting that W.C. Seller, the other half of the Seller and Yeatman 1066 and all that combination, tried to do a similar thing a few years later, went on to live in a cottage but couldn't make it work, so he ended up teaching at Charterhouse. So Pete showed he had something.
All right, we like Seller and Yeatman as well. So his work was very much broader than the work I know him for, though, his history books, wasn't it? So give us a short potted history of his work.
Peach involves himself in a kind of bewildering number of enterprises. He's an infantry officer, a teacher, a punch humorist, a university lecturer, a university fundraiser, a writer, a pioneer of early radio, a popular radio personality, a magazine editor, a producer of historical pageants, a theatrical entrepreneur, a playwright, and a Ladybird history author.
So he was a pioneer in early radio then?
Yes, he scored some notable firsts. His play Light and Shade in 1924, for instance, was the first comedy broadcast on the BBC. I think it was a comedy in the sense that nobody died, but it's commonly regarded as the second play specifically written for radio to be broadcast. He was also the first to spoof events from British history, Heterodyne history, historical events as they might have been in 1927.
And what was his contribution to the development of the format of radio broadcasting then?
Well, he was a genuine innovator. He developed radio drama and history programmes into what you could say was a recognisably modern format. He used a variety of sound effects to reconstruct the past and to create a sound world for listeners that had the feel of kind of real authenticity. Second, Peach introduced a convincingly natural everyday speech for characters from the past, which replaced the kind of affected stage acting version of English, which had been the norm before.
It's interesting. Wolf and I, who did another podcast, just listened to Cromwell and remarking that all the working class characters have an extremely pronounced accent, but maybe this is slightly different.
Yeah.
So it's interesting he's an innovator, given that, you know, he's got a reputation for very traditional history.
Yeah, and we can feel his work today because he's one of the first to use the device of an ordinary person to be the narrator of a radio play. Sometimes it's the page boy, for instance. And we can experience Peach's innovation firsthand when we get an audio guide from historic site, you know, National Trust, English Heritage, that kind of thing. Because apart from an obsession about where the toilets are and how people did it in the past, that they also, there's a narration by the lady of the house or a maid, that kind of thing. And it's kind of pure Peach. He pioneered that approach in the 30s and 40s.
Well, that is a definite win. I went around Kenilworth yesterday and the signage and information available now is so much better at historical sites than it used to be.
Yeah, and we can thank Peach in part for that, I guess. He pioneered the use of sound effects to signal a change in scenes, such as seagulls or waves, for instance. I think the early BBC had a microphone permanently on at Bournemouth so that they could have the sound of the waves on tap. But he was also a cutting-edge radio dramatist, a kind of household name, and a name who didn't shy away from controversial issues, including the war, arms race, pacifism. His radio play Patriotism Limited in 1937 was subject to a BBC internal censorship and pulled from the air. And this was a decision that was reported around the world.
Well, we've all been censored by the BBC after all, you know, haven't we? We've all done it. So he was a bit of a controversial figure then.
Yeah, in some ways he was. Several of his radio plays touched on racial issues and his stance on the subject was more nuanced than many of his contemporaries. And his attitudes, in a sense, were kind of ahead of his time. In Ingredient X, 1929, he presented corporate greed and the exploitation of Africa, spurring a contemporary journalist to complain that the play was quote-unquote Bolshevist in tendency.
God, it's strange to hear about Peach being accused of being a Bolshe.
Yeah. So he also shifted, another one of his career shifts, he got into film, running film scripts. He wrote about 30 scripts for films and a number of different scenarios. He wrote the Dad's Army forerunner Get Cracking in 1943, which starred the then big star George Formby, which was a caper that Peach had adapted from his own play about the Home Guard, according to plan. And in music, Hath Charms, 1935, he devised that was essentially one of the first pop videos or a proto pop video, and it was Gilbert Taylor who eventually ended up doing the cinematography for Star Wars. Kind of worked on this, and he worked on A Hard Day's Night for the Beatles as well. So there's some kind of continuity there.
Ah, great. So at some stage, he gets involved with Lady Bird from 1956, I think. Should we go back a step and talk about Loughborough's Finest then? Where did Lady Bird as a brand come from?
Yeah, well, they were published by the Loughborough publisher Wills and Hepworth. They produced a lot of brochures eventually for the car industry, but they're not a classic publishing house. The Lady Bird story goes back to the First World War, 1915, when they're just looking for a source of additional revenue in a disrupted market, and they tapped into the growing demand for illustrated children's books. And so, but the format we tend to think of today, the mini hardback format, was a kind of post-World War II phenomenon. I think Wills and Hepworth had originally intended to discontinue children's publishing after the end of the Second World War and go back into printing the glossy brochures for the motor industry of the West Midlands.
So what happened then?
Well, it was really the sheer determination of one employee, Douglas Keane, that the directors of the company changed their minds. Keane happened to have a wife and a mother-in-law who were trained artists, which was pretty convenient.
Yeah, handy.
He worked with them on a homemade mock-up of a book that became British Birds and Their Nests, published in 1953. And this was the first title in Lady Bird's new Nature series. And, you know, Keane's persistence paid off. A second run of 50,000 copies of British Birds Their Nest quickly followed. And by the time he retired in 1974, there'd been a huge growth in sales. 24,000 of the standard book format books were sold in 1946, but this increased to 24 million in 1974.
God, that's quite an increase. Well, three of them were sold to me because I had each one of the series. Loved them. For whom were the Lady Bird books designed then?
Well, they're designed to be accessible to kids, but also to be bought as presents and prizes by schools, teachers, parents, grandparents, libraries who wanted to give children, as I said, prizes or presents. And the sales and marketing and production techniques were definitely up to date.
So how were they marketed then?
Well, Douglas Keane realised that the books had to stand out in bookshops, and so he commissioned special display cabinets as well as window display units to market the books in a colourful and an attractive way. And they were kind of revolutionary in terms of design and content, these books, and sold for a relatively low price of 2 and 6.
Oh, I remember those heady days of trying to get a spinner into Waterstones, as long as you managed to get the buyer drunk at lunch first, of course. It was de rigueur. They picked on a very distinctive and very effective format, didn't they? Can you explain what that was and how they arrived at it?
Yeah, the format of the books arose because they were manufactured by Wills and Hepworth himself, and they'd originally been, as I said, a small kind of revenue-generating sideline, and they're things that can be produced on their presses between gaps and other print jobs.
So these were just a sort of sideline?
Yeah. I mean, there's also the influence of World War II. The size, structure and format of the post-war books were a legacy of paper rationing and the war economy standard. So there was a concern to minimise wastage.
Ah, make do and mend. Waste not, want not, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, so they had to conform to the largest piece. They made a book out of the largest piece of paper that was available to them, 40 inches by 30 inches, and they wanted to use the sheet to the maximum, and it enabled them by some kind of tessellation to come up with a kind of 56 page book that could be printed from a single sheet of paper, and that allowed for the kind of classic format of a full color illustration on every right hand page.
So that's the way they do. I absolutely love that format. I must admit, it worked brilliantly for me.
Yeah, it just meant the books could be produced efficiently and cheaply, and the presses could run without hindrance, and they could produce a large volume at a low cost. And that the low cost element, the relatively low cost element, was a key feature in their success.
Okay, for many people in the UK, I guess it's not just the history books that are the most famous. They did a whole range of other things. So reading, who could forget Peter and Jane? I mean, I love the Bird books, as I say, but so how far did The Range extend and what were the most successful series?
I mean, there are a huge number of books produced on an extraordinary range of topics. Wills and Hepworth found talented authors and illustrators to produce material for a one-off fixed fee, and it became a huge publishing phenomenon. The best, I think, as you said, Peter and Jane, what they call it, the keywords reading scheme, 85 million copies sold, also exported across the world to places like Pakistan, India, Singapore.
I can still feel the pain, actually. Jane hit Peter, Peter hit Jane, Jane strangles the dog, all that sort of thing.
So, yeah, for many parents and children, though, Lady Bird was synonymous with the nature books, you know, what to look for in spring, what to look for in summer, what to look for in autumn and winter. And they were illustrated by the respected and renowned painter Charles Frederick Tunnicliffe. They were particularly well known. In terms of adventures from history, there were 49 titles published between 1956 and 78. It was one of the largest Ladybird series and one of the most popular, with 13.5 million sold.
Ah, excellent. So now we get to it. So when did the idea of history books occur to Ladybird? How did Peach then get involved?
Well, I think Keane was always looking for a market to shift books, right? So and they already had a connection with one of the BBC radio uncles from Children's Hour, Derek McCulloch, who's known as Uncle Mac. And I think he had a connection with Peach because Peach also worked for the BBC Radio and for Children's Hour. So it's just a natural step, I guess, to bring on board another radio personality, a household name.
So one of the most brilliant things about the books were those history images. Many of them have stayed with me ever since childhood. Absolutely central to the magic of the books. I remember Richard I sweating in the Holy Land. The image of the princesses in the tower, a really spooky image. Duke of Clarence fleeing down muddy lanes. They're always in my mind. So was there just one illustrator working on the history books, as there was one author, or were there several, and who were they?
Well, there's really a couple. The main one is the artist and illustrator John Kenny, who illustrated 31 of the titles between 54 and 72. He was a D-Day veteran, and although he hadn't been an official war artist, recorded the landings and his regiment's progress with drawings that he made at first hand. That kind of gives a sense of kind of vibrancy to the pictures he creates in a different context for the adventures in history. But he also worked on a number of Ladybird series, including Silver Arrow, Robin Hood Adventure, Tootles the Taxi, The Circus Comes to Town. He's also responsible for Reverend Audrey's Railway series from 57 to 62, Thomas the Tank Engine.
Oh, we all love those.
Yeah, so he's most famous, though, I guess, for these illustrations of the adventures from history. And they're really crammed with detail. There's just so much going on. The pictures complemented the text and helped drive the story along. And they created an atmosphere, a kind of a feeling. Kenny and Peach worked on, I think, 29 books from Alfred the Great till the Pilgrim Fathers in 1972. Alfred the Great, 56, 1956. Pilgrim Fathers, 1972, before Kenny's ill health broke up the partnership.
But also, yeah, they were absolutely superb.
Yeah, there was also Frank Hampson, who was another World War II veteran, who was also the creator of Dan Dare, amongst other things. He did the illustrations for the Kings and Queens book 1 and 2, and a couple of the adventures from history. I've got an original of his Battle of Crecy, which is quite a fun thing to have.
Right.
So he loved trying to squeeze in as much detail as possible while still maintaining the overall look of the image. You know, he often used friends and family members as models. He took photos of them, sometimes in costume, in the poses that he wanted. You know, people today can sometimes see Ladybird books as a bit old-fashioned, but quite a lot of up-to-date technology went into their production.
Oh, okay. Give me an example.
So, for instance, Frank Hampton bought one of the first Polaroid cameras to get an immediate image of what he wanted. And so the images of the Kings and Queens book are actually quite vibrant. As I said, I've got an original. They're not quite as colourful as the originals, but they have a sense of kind of purpose and immediacy to them. But I guess that the ones that were printed, it reflected the printing technology of the time.
It's a very distinctive style as well, isn't it, that extends to all the Ladybird history books, isn't there? A sort of simple, direct, active language, short sentences. A style which has led to a series of mildly amusing send-ups recently, like The Wife and The Shed. What was Peach's approach to historical writing and history? Do you think he had a particular approach? Was he seeking to inspire, to educate, create a national story, or what?
Well, certainly, I think Peach wrote children's books with unusual flair, elegance, and sophistication. And he's a man who enjoyed the play of language and the art of the spoken word even.
Do you think Peach saw the past as a theatre, a sort of drama?
Yeah, I mean, he has a long association with drama, and he certainly quarried the past for material to transform into archetypes. You know, he was a playwright. He wanted to move his audience with him and use the tricks of the dramatist to get things, people to see things from a different perspective. So he's not like a purist. It's not enough just to be right. He has to take his audience with him. His style of storytelling is very influential. For instance, it's credited as an influence on the early episodes of the BBC television series Doctor Who.
Doctor Who, was he also therefore responsible for the wobbly sets and non-scary monsters?
Well, probably.
Was he an academic or a popularizer?
Well, he'd been a university lecturer, but he was more of an intellectual with wide-ranging issues than a mere academic with a limited area of expertise.
A mere academic, David, careful.
Yeah, I know. Well, Exeter, he was making a lot of money from his writing and broadcasting than he was from being a lecturer. You know, he lived in a hotel and was the only member of the lecturing staff to run a car. You know, his colleagues probably hated it. He's just a bit too flash. So Exeter was a bit of an intellectual backwater in those days, and he's like a big fish in a small pond.
I'd like to just formally apologise not only to mere academics, but officially to the good citizens of Exeter, and distance myself from those scurrilous comments, David.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, but more seriously... Peach was definitely capable of being an academic historian or a scholar of literature. It's just his interest didn't really lie in that direction. You know, he had the historian's fine-grained attention to detail, but he also found it hard to resist the lure of the nicely turned phrase. So I don't think he's particularly interested in trying to create a national story, but he was kind of happy to send that sort of thing up as a dramatist. I just think he liked the technical and intellectual challenge of writing a short book on a complex subject.
Right. Let's come to the other reason, I think, why the books are omnipresent on my podcast, which is the view of history they present. And they do come in for a bit of stick, don't they, from some places. So, for example, you just talked about how he was ahead of his time, and now the perception is that he's a bit of a relic with very out-of-date traditional values on the role of women, religion, and things like the reign of Henry VIII.
Yeah, I mean, the focus tends to be on narrative history and the idea that history is shaped by the actions of great men, and just occasionally women get a look into. Characters presented, though, were ones the readership at the time could relate to. There was a sense that readers in the 1950s and 60s were just like people in the past, only different. These are not histories of impassive overarching forces. Individuals mattered, but the nature of individualism, people's everyday concerns were in a sense timeless, unchanging. This made the past accessible, domesticated, if you will. And I suppose there was this sense of the drama and romance of history.
Right. So why does he seem a bit old-fashioned these days?
Yeah, he does come in for some kind of stick. He gets presented as a kind of gentlemanly popularizer of the Kings and Queens school of history. And to his critics, they say he produced an oversimplified, narrow-minded history suffused with the illusions of post-war Britain. And you can kind of see a little bit of it in Captain Cook, for instance, where there's a bit of a traditional patriotic tone about the kind of great explorers venturing out from English shores and... Well, on the last section of the book where he's saying, Cook gets killed by native people, and you get the impression that he was just minding his own business, not hurting anyone. But also, he produced a very positive book on Napoleon. It is different in that Napoleon can be compared to Hitler. He's not on that line. He's very positive about Napoleon, but you don't get much of a sense about how Napoleon was kind of disastrous for women's rights in France, and people have said that Napoleon committed genocide in Haiti. So there's a few things that are not emphasized, maybe.
So he's guilty as charged, is he?
Yeah, well, he's not. I mean, you've got to remember, he's not a completely free spirit. I mean, he's writing a children's book for a market, you know, it's not the same as being an academic. And, you know, his publisher had limited interest in cutting across the grain of conventional views. There's a sort in Lady Bird books, you'd find a celebration of nature, but also of progress, such as building of motorways, you know, and you might also find stereotypical portraits of family life. They were products of their time, but, you know, real life is complex and sometimes contradictory. Douglas Keane, who, as you know, was the driving force behind the books, later became a director of the company and got into the trappings of success. You know, he had his suits made to measure. You know, but at the same time, he was an avowed socialist and enthusiastic Guardian reader. You know, people aren't always who you think they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, the books were products of their time, but they weren't artless regurgitations of conventional understandings. And that gives them a kind of enduring quality. Mm. They're far from being run-of-the-mill. And I suppose there's that sort of dynamic interplay of text and illustration that makes them magical.
Yeah, I mean, that's what really worked for me, I have to say, that interplay. So you're talking about specific things about the histories. I am going to mention a few controversies that I have come across about the books, and then I might want to move on to what your favourite book is and so on. So, number one, Richard III and the Twins in the Tower. Has to be say, Ricardians, not difficult to upset, but I think it was, you know, the twins were killed by Richard III as far as Dugard Peach was concerned. Someone, shall remain nameless, got very cross about the presentation of Henry VIII in the Elizabeth books and smelled, slightly unfairly, I thought, a strain of anti-Catholicism. Another one, he's rather unforgiving about Richard I. He was a bad king, he wrote, which, you know, hurt, David.
I can feel it. It's visceral.
Yeah. Visceral. I mean, you know, and it's also riled John Gillingham, his, you know, Richard's definitive biographer. Then there was Cromwell. Do you remember the Cromwell book?
Yeah.
So he presents a traditional heroic view of the Cromwell, the Cromwell we'd really like Oliver to be. Although actually, interesting enough, he doesn't shy away from criticising him for what he did in Ireland, which is quite interesting.
I mean, he does have that story about the baby Oliver Cromwell being abducted by a monkey, which allows Kenny to go to town on the illustration.
Well, I mean, it's obviously true, David.
Obviously true. And, you know, he's got the fisticuffs with Charles I in there as well, which...
Yes, that's bound to have happened.
It's a story that has a long history to it, and it was a contemporary story, and he Peach is a sucker for a good story, and he won't let it get in the way. You know, it's going to go in.
Yeah, quite right too. I couldn't possibly comment. Henry VIII, so pretty pre-revisionist. I mean, this was the view of the time, actually, you know, the great man approach of Henry the Reformation, the sort of far thinking, strategic man who did great things. But actually there again, you know, it's relatively recent that a much more critical view has emerged on Henry VIII than Henry VIII now, online anyway, some of us several yards below the salt.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Peach died in 1974 before a lot of the historiography came out, not all of it, but some of it certainly.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, people have rewritten the history of the late medieval church and so on as well. And then Britain shaped the world, obviously, you know, as far as the Peach books, as you said, actually, we went out, explored, and, you know, Britain shaped the world. It's a bit sweeping. Okay, well, I suppose a theme for me, actually, is that I find the criticism sometimes a bit absurd because these were, as you said earlier, books created at a particular time. And they did actually make changes, didn't they? So, as I remember on the Britain Shape the World thing, the Walter Raleigh book changed the perspective of when he arrives in the New World to one of Native Americans out rather than as they had been, sort of Walter Raleigh out. So, I mean, and I have to say, I firmly believe presentism is the enemy of historical inquiry. We just need to hope that we are kindly judged in the future, because we will be judged in the future. Or am I defending the indefensible, David? You know, women doing all the housework, Britain as an entirely white society, all that sort of thing. Accusations that have all been levelled at the series.
Yeah, I think history writing tends to reflect present concerns. You know, around the time of 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, there was a renewed interest in, for instance, in the Crusades. You know, people are now doing more writing and research about the history of pandemics. As you said, Lady Bird update, modernised, gave the books a makeover after to prepare them for the 1980s, a few years after Peach's death. And people at the time thought there were pluses and minuses. Some people preferred characterful books, even if they could be seen as unbalanced in some ways. I guess every generation tends to feel they've understood the right way of thinking about things.
Yes. It's absolutely true, yeah.
And I think Peach has got a bit of irony about himself. He's not a kind of purist. He wants to take his audience along with him. And I guess, just going back to what you said, our attitudes of our own day will be put under the microscope at some point, and people will look back in 50 years' time and think, you know, what were we thinking of? But most of us try our best by our own lights, I guess. And I guess we become grumpy or more unreasonable as we get older, or at least some people do.
Actually. I can vouch for that. Okay, so what are your favourite works by Peach? And then we can go on.
Well, I mean, I think one of his plays, actually, he wrote a series of like one-act plays. And you know, Henry VIII is famous for his wives. And Laurie Peach took an idea and transformed it into something hilarious. In 1959, he wrote this short play, Four Queens Wait for Henry, which was a one-act play for a solely female cast. Yeah, he did a lot of plays for female cast, which is kind of an unusual aspect as well. Given what we were talking about earlier, but it's a kind of a fantasy set in the next world, set in heaven, that revolves around four of Henry's queens who died before him. The action is set in temporal time in 1547, the year of Henry's death, as you know, and the plot takes the form of an argument between the four queens about who's really Henry's wife. It just tickles me every time. I think it's great.
Sounds like a good one. Okay, then finally, the last thing. What specifically of the history books stick in your mind most? What I would start off with on the bidding on is the image of Alexander the Great on his horse rising across the desert. And then there were images of his Persian queen, Roxana, which I absolutely had a mega crush on at that age. Sorry, forgive me, Roxana. I was young, you know, only 25, you know. What about you?
I suppose the one that speaks to me most is the first one, King Alfred the Great. And it was, I'm being a bit geeky here, but it had the earlier version of the Lady Bird logo with the open wings. I love the illustrated map at the beginning and at the end of the book, No Space Wasted. The illustrations are kind of, you know, anachronistic, arguably, but well-executed, exciting and fun. They're vivid, colourful, with lots of detail. They give a great sense of movement, purpose and drama. And then this was a revelation at the time. I'm amused by just Peach's description of the Fid. I can never pronounce Fid, a sort of home guard. You know, Peach, as you know, had served as a major in the home guard and wrote a play on his experiences, which was, as I said, turned into a film starring George Formby.
I can't imagine George Formby as Alfred the Great, actually. I must admit, it's quite an image.
Maybe with Banjo. Yes,
that's right, yes. Wooing Guthrum with his cleaning windows. Okay, another couple from me. So Charles II stepping ashore in Bay in 1660 with the most ridiculous pair of shiny blue pantaloons. Absolute triumph. Florence and her lamp and the Greeks. Marvellous, actually fantastic. The Greeks standing around in agoras discussing great things, having earth-shattering thoughts. Henry V loved that one. The colours of the medieval times, so much truer to life than many modern takes on the Middle Ages, especially in film, where, you know, you got all these dull grey, brown colours, where it was full of colours, especially from royalty like Henry V. Roman Britain and Agricola, do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. I love the pictures of them standing with the ships as they go and invade Scotland. I have to say, it was a rather limited view of Roman Britain. He nails King John, I reckon. I think he got that pretty much right. He wasn't a fan. And John's reputation, unlike Richard's, has not recovered. And then that Kings and Queens series you mentioned, they were an absolute tour de force. Impossible not to upset somebody when you've got a page or less per rule. But really simple, really direct. Of course, incredibly selective, because they had to be. So, I mean, so many more that I could mention, but I'm getting boring. But Nelson, Elizabeth, Cromwell, Richard Lionheart. And then, of course, the actual pinnacle of all of them, Warwick the Kingmaker, which was undoubtedly my fave of all time.
Yeah, that's great. The illustrations are marvellous there.
Fantastic in that, yeah. Really good. Okay, so we've probably delighted the listeners enough. So where do we end then, David? Just give me a summary of Lawrence's work and his contribution to history.
Well, it's kind of hard to think of a historian who's inspired more people or at least sold more books and shaped our views of English history more than Eldegard Peach. You know, he's extraordinarily creative. You know, he wrote felicitously with a twist of humour. You know, academics tend to be a bit sniffy about people like Peach, but you know, few people have had as busy and a successful creative life as Eldegard Peach.
Yeah, and I certainly agree that he's influenced a whole load of people to do with history in a way that the horrible histories did in my children's youth. So look, David, thank you very much for sharing your expertise and enthusiasm for Lawrence Dugard Peach. So look, everyone, that's it. Come and join us on Facebook as normal, because it would be a hoot to have a chat with those of you who are also inspired or remember the Lady Bird books, or indeed hate them. Come and tell us which are your favourite, whether in Peter and Jane made you want to poke your eyes out, how angry you are that Henry VIII wasn't pilloried for killing so many wives, or whatever, all the books that inspired you. The site is up now, of course. And there's also a bit of a quiz that I did many years ago about the pictures, so you can have a go at that too.
In the quiz, you get a choice of some of those fantastic images, and you're asked in each question to match the right image to the right historical character. It's a bit of fun, which was very popular when it was launched way back in 2017. Gosh, doesn't time fly when you're having fun? It's
on the website, thehistoryofengland.co.uk.
One more thing, everyone. If you want to know more about Peach, David has put his recent lectures and slides up on YouTube. You can find it on the History of England website again, thehistoryofengland.co.uk, in the post for this episode.
And David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, just one more thing, everyone, an announcement. In a change to the scheduled programme, next week we will have a poll and prize draw. Can you believe your good luck? It is called the Good Old Cause Poll, because we are approaching what I will stubbornly insist on calling the English Revolution. Now, contain yourself, don't shout out and pump the air with your fist. You might knock over that pile of ironing or punch your neighbouring commuter on the snozzle. And like the big ship on the Alley Alley O, that would never, never do. So, next week instead, we will have an episode on the historiography of La Révolution Anglaise, which is quite a story, I can tell you. Lord, have we picked over that over the years. To accompany the episode, I thought we'd have a poll, why not, to gather together your views, based on whatever prior knowledge, great or distant, on the cause of the conflict, and what your allegiance might have been had you been there. So, next week, look out for the episode and the poll on thehistoryofengland.co.uk, and if you want, there will be a prize draw that you can enter for one of two coins. There are two coins on offer. You can win one of them. So, have a go. You'll have a week or two to answer the poll and enter, because then we will have the two advertised episodes on W.G. Hoskins's Great Rebuilding of England and Life in a Jacobean Country House, before moving on to Charles the Martyr, the Man of Blood. Good? See you there, then. I can barely contain my glee that we've finally, almost made it. Good luck, everyone. Gird those loins, gentle listeners. I bid thee gird, like Mama used to tell you. And I'll see you next week.